This I know.
It's even quicker than a draw of the breath.
Words can be harmful.
What happened here?
Looking back on it,
I thought to feel like that.
That was my
joy's moment.
Life.
And I thought, man.
Well, and suddenly
something snapped.
Life's changed.
I shouldn't say
I
that.
I like to stir it up a bit. I can't help myself.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
In 2005, Jill Hicks was living in London. She was running late for work one morning. There were problems on the Northern Line, because there are always problems on the Northern Line, so Jill got on the Piccadilly Line instead. Standing near her in the tube carriage was a man called Jermaine Lindsay, who'd taken the name Abdullah Shaheed Jamal, and he had a bomb with him. In the explosion, Jill lost both her legs below the knee, but really it's a wonder she survived at all, and it's such a good thing she did, because Jill Hicks is an amazing person. She refused to hate the people who perpetrated this crime. She insisted that the cycle of hatred that inspired this crime should stop with her. And she formed a charity that's called Making a Difference for Peace, or MAD for Peace for short. Hi, Jill.
Hi.
What kind of a relationship do you have with your new legs? How do you see them?
A love-hate relationship. I love them because they enable me to stand. They enable me to take steps forward and to feel, in inverted commas, normal. They've also enabled me to be much taller than I used to be in real life.
Is that something you wanted to be?
Absolutely. So I used to be just over 5 foot, and I hated life as a 5 foot female, especially living in London with an Australian accent. And so any opportunity, the first thing I said to the consultant was, actually, I was thinking of gaining a couple of inches here. And he said that the plan really is to start you quite short. So they would normally look at, say, 4 foot for your centre of gravity to enable me to walk. And I had a wonderful croaky voice, so like a jazz singer who'd smoked too much, you know, from the waking up in intensive care. And I just said, "Darling, I've been through enough trauma. I thought I'd be 6 foot." And that was it. So I'm here today at just under 5'7".
Can you stare down all sorts of people you weren't able to stare down?
Absolutely. I just need to stand at the end of a bar, and that's all that matters.
Do you have names for your artificial legs?
I don't. The way I talk about my stumps, so the bits that are the residual limb, are that they're my twin boys. So they were born in July 2005, and they're coming up to 7, a real handful, wanting to do all the things that 7-year-olds do. But, of course, they're attached to mum. And, you know, so they're my little twin boys. Yeah.
Fantastic. How long does it take to slip the prosthetic limbs on?
It varies, actually. So quite often it depends on – I have I think what's very interesting about this type of injury is that you have no idea of what you're going into. And so every single day is quite different. So the stumps or the boys might just decide, "I don't want to play ball today." So they won't go in their prosthetic leg because the way it's been – the limb has been severed, there's a lot of sort of nerve endings that are still quite fragile. So they just don't want to be contained in these legs. And I've always tried to think of how could I describe what it's like to wear prosthetic legs. And I think all that I could possibly think of is that it's like having your something in a vice whilst you're balancing on stilts. So it could be close to that sensation. So that's why every day it's different. So it can be 10 minutes, it can be 20 minutes.
Is it lovely to take them off at the end of the day and have a glass of wine?
Oh, it's just divine. The only thing I hate is that I'm then, you know, 2 feet off the ground. So I'm crawling around with my glass of wine rather than elegantly strutting through the house.
There's a perfectly good explanation for it.
Literally crawling home.
You walked from Leeds all the way to London, from Yorkshire to London, 270 miles in these prosthetic limbs. Who did you visit on the way for that walk?
Well, the project was quite unique. It started from the three of the four suicide bombers came from an area up in Leeds, or several areas up in Leeds. And I went to those communities, which of course were absolutely devastated by what had happened, because these were their boys, and no one could have imagined what had unfolded and what their intentions were. And so I went to those communities and said, "What can we do? What can I do? What can we do together? Because it's important to have a united front. It's important to build bridges for people to cross." And just a wild idea. So we were looking at lots of different things we could do together. And a wild idea, I sort of sat there and said, "What if I walked from Leeds to London?" And unanimously, everybody said, "Great idea." And I thought, "Oh, I was only joking."
Now I've got to walk from now, Leeds to London.
Oh, well. What's the worst that can happen, you know? But the premise of it was, if I can do the most difficult thing for me, which is to walk and to even contemplate that distance, what we're asking people to do is, it's not about me. It's about me as a symbolic idea. But we're asking people in each community, and there was 22 towns and cities along the way, to say, come out and walk and talk with somebody who you believe is very different from you. And I guarantee that by the end of a mile, you'll understand that you have far more in common than you do different.
That's much better than asking people to sit at a table, isn't it, actually? Yeah. Because you're walking together. Walking together is a really lovely thing.
This is it, Richard. It's the act of walking cuts through all the rubbish, because there is no pleasantries, because you have to walk and get straight on with it, with the conversation. And that's what we saw happening. And there was a lovely story, if I could just share it quickly, that we were in Beeston, an area in Leeds, and there was a Muslim family and a non-Muslim family that had lived across the road from each other for over 10 years, never talked to each other. And I listened to this conversation, and the non-Muslim woman said to the man across the road, "Well, you lot don't like women, so that's why I've never really said a word to you." And he said, "Are you serious? Love women, you know." And he said, "Well, I've never said anything to you, because I just gathered we'll just keep to ourselves, and you know. And within 10 minutes, they were both complaining about the rubbish at number 19. And I thought... So it's a belief in setting up environments and platforms for people just to be people and humanity at its best.
Your philosophy seems to be rooted in the great truism that people are actually kind of the same everywhere in the world. Mm. Some places there's some rather nasty people who have managed to get the whip hand, which makes the culture kind of crazy. But people essentially are the same, really. I mean,
absolutely. And I mean, it's terrible to generalize, but you know, for the sake of what our topic that we're talking about, I think it is safe to say that most people worry about the roof over their head, the lives of their children, how to better their own lives. We all have very similar concerns and fears and hopes for our lives.
We'll talk some more a bit later about Man for Peace, which is an amazing thing, and about the Al-Qaeda model that it's based on. We'll talk to that about that in a moment. First of all, Jill, why were you living in London at the time of the bombing? How long had you been there for, and what were you doing?
I'd been there 12, 13 years, and I was one of the, I guess, the great Australian rite of passage, where you head off to Europe and do your 2 years tour of duty and then come back home again. And I just sort of forgot to come back. I've just racked up my 20th year away, and feel very much that strange beast of being a Londoner, but I cry at the Australian National Anthem. I cry at Peter Allen, "I Still Call Australia Home," and that's even the panpipe version in a lift. I just, you know, so I'm Australian through and through, but also this strange beast that is proud to call myself a Londoner.
Were you a bit of a workaholic back then and now?
A complete workaholic. It's very interesting because I think to rationalize the entirety of my life, I've looked at it as life number one, the bombing, and then life number two. And everything in life number one was about Jill furthering herself, Jill pushing forward. What can I do? And I left Australia because very sadly my parents died quite close to each other, a year apart from each other. And I was with Mum when she died. And I'm an Adelaide girl. I was holding Mum's hand. And as Mum's hand fell out of mine, I looked at this wonderful woman. And that was my first understanding of death. And I just thought, wow, what is life? What can I do? I know that if I stay in Adelaide, I kind of know what's going to happen. I'm going to have a beautiful Labrador called Sam. I'm going to have four kids. I'm going to have a station wagon. And life's going to be nice. And I wanted more than nice. I mean, it's strange, isn't it, how then you work the whole way to come back full circle, where you just having a Labrador and four kids would have been great right now. You know? But I needed to say, what can Jill do? And that's what I went off in search of.
What kind of a planner were you, Jill, when it came to time and being on time for appointments?
Meticulous, early for everything. And always would build in a sort of a buffer of if something ever happens or goes wrong, buffer. And so I was at everything early, and I was always at my desk at 7:30 every morning. I was the only person in an office block, probably about 200 people, 200 staff, that I knew the security guards by their first name. I knew what their wives were called, and I felt proud of that. I've questioned all that after the bombing, but at the time I thought, how wonderful, I'm the only person that really gets anything done around here, you know. And it's very strange. I lived my life by my urgent folder and in the days before iPhones, by my Filofax, ticking things off a list and making sure I've, you know, written a new list and, yeah.
The day of that attack, you amazingly and weirdly, you were running late.
Mm.
How that never happens, does it? I mean,
never happens. It was. And upon reflection, you know, you just think, gosh, everything conspired that morning that to enable me to be on that carriage at that time when a bomb went off. And, you know, I've been told since that statistically I'd have more chance of winning the lottery than being in a bomb blast. And you think, of course, but would I win a lottery? No. And strangely, I mean, that morning I was engaged at the time of the bombing, and I had one of those arguments that was absolutely, I was certain that was it. And I was leaving him that, you know, subsequently that week. And I thought, my life needs to change. I need to change what I'm doing. And that meant that I was late, but it also meant that I was wearing a scarf because the fiancé was sort of being quite sound asleep, and I was furious. So I was banging drawers around and trying to, you know, make sure that my aggression was well noted. And through that process, found a scarf and put a scarf on, which I never generally wear, which later in the piece turned out to crucially save my life. So the
argument made you late.
The argument made
but
me late.
Also
then I
gave
got
you
to the
scarf.
It gave me a scarf. I got to the tube station. I didn't have my weekly pass with me, so I had to buy another ticket. So all of these things added up. As you said in the intro, I was on the Northern Line. The Northern Line didn't appear. Making decisions. I changed tube trains at King's Cross maybe three times a year, and that was one of the times I did.
You remember the shoes you were wearing that day?
I did. They were beautiful, white, paint and leather, 1950s pointed. And at the bottom of the sole, they had an impression of James Dean with the words rebel. And, they were my favourite shoes.
Also getting on board the tube was Jermaine Lindsay, also known as Abdullah Shahid Jamal. Did you by any chance, I mean, you don't look at anyone else on the tube, do you?
You don't.
Did you see him at all?
It's etiquette, you know, that I had to learn, you know, by being an Aussie in London, that you don't, there's no conversation, there's no looking at anybody, it's eyes down and silence, basically. And I think also being 5 foot, I never got to see anybody. You know, it was, I could describe chests, but that's about it. And sadly, even the wonderful man that was standing in between myself and Jermaine Lindsay, I wish I could have remembered him, because he was the first point of saving my life.
So there was just one man between you and Jermaine Lindsay. Mm.
I've had the great, great honour of meeting his wife. So he sadly lost his life. He left behind two little children. And his wife, unbelievable that she so graciously said, if this is the last thing he did with his life to save mine, then what a wonderful thing he's done as his last moments.
Do you recall the detonation? Do you recall any sound or light or anything?
Nothing. It's even quicker than a draw of the breath. So I've often thought, is it like a click of a finger? But a click would suggest a sound. It was just, and suddenly life's changed. It was just black, completely black.
What did you think was happening to you?
I thought I was dead. I thought I'd had a heart attack, and that I was dead. And of course, we don't know what dead is. So I thought, this is dead. I'm dead. And it was strange that it was actually, and again, this idea of motionless, timeless, black space. And that, I guess, the filmic idea of life flashing before you, in front of you, and backwards and forwards, and little neurons going off, little flashing lights.
But that really happened, did it?
Absolutely. But all in a race of a breath as well. And I thought that I'm dead. Something must have happened. I've had a heart attack, and I'm dead. And it was only when I could hear. I lost quite a lot of my hearing. I've lost one eardrum and I have half an eardrum left. But I could hear screams, and I thought initially people are screaming at me because I've just died. And then I thought, no, there's too many screams for that. And in a way that was so comforting, because I realised I'm not dead. Whatever's happened, we're all in this together. So
what you're saying to me reminds me that we know with hindsight what happened, but of course you couldn't.
I had no idea. I didn't even know it was a bomb till I was in hospital, till I woke up.
So you had this feeling then of being like suspended or falling, or
it's like absolutely like falling. It's like falling in or being cushioned by thick black tar, and that you're sort of suspended in this mass of darkness. And that's what to me felt like facing an abyss. I had no idea what it was. It's just that in the draw of a breath, it's like extremes. So at the moment we're sitting here in a studio, it's like in the time it could take just to go, we could be underwater in the Adelaide Torrens River or something. And you think, I'm not even going to think about how we got there. It's suddenly we're in water. We don't know how that happened.
Could you breathe?
No. So only now that I know what had happened with my injuries, so lungs had collapsed, but was fighting for breath. A passenger, so those who could get out did get out and called the alarm for help. But a fellow passenger must have picked me up and put me on what remained of a bench seat, and because I was in and out of consciousness. And when I woke up, suddenly the amount of people had reduced, and there I was sitting in a quite a serene greyness now, because the black had lifted, with those who had sadly lost their lives and those like me who were badly injured.
What you say serene? I would imagine there'd be lots of screaming and crying.
No, people talking to each other. at one stage I had to, well, there were, obviously were people in great distress, and so everyone was trying to calm people down. There was just a quietness about it, a stillness about it. And there was one girl that was talking to me. I could see that I'd lost both legs. This is where the wonderful scarf came in, because I still had the scarf on, and calmly managed to tie tourniquets around the tops of my legs. And I knew that I was in a very, very, very serious situation. But there was a girl across saying, you know, what's your name and what do you do, and trying to keep each other awake. And I ended up having to say, I need to stop talking now. I'll let you all know that I'm still here, but I'm going to conserve all the energy and the breath. And I focused on my watch and just stared into my watch.
You said that there were two voices in your head talking to you, addressing you. Mm. What were they saying?
It's such an amazing experience of feeling. My impression of that is that I was being offered a choice. Did I want to die or did I want to live? And that choice was quite difficult to make, because death, the death's voice was absolutely beautiful, and it was female, and it was calm, and it was saying to me, Jill, look at your injuries. You won't the legs won't be saved. Do you really want to live like that? Come with me now. And it felt so beautiful, this presentation of an idea of being dead. And as I was contemplating that idea, what I would only call the voice of life piped up, and it was angry and it was furious and it was almost yelling at me, saying, how dare you for a single moment entertain not being here? Whether you've got legs, whether you haven't got legs, there is a lot for you to do. And I think in that moment, I instinctively knew my life would be very different, not about the physical, but about what I'd go on to do with my life.
That voice of life, was that female as well?
No, it was male. Bloody men.
Always give you the hard option.
Absolutely, yeah.
The tougher option. Yes. No, 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 you can't have that.
That's
nice.
It.
No, you can't have a nap. That's the voice.
Where's my Ferrari?
The voice of men, yeah. Telling a woman she can't rest.
That's it. There's food to put on the table.
Who or what was that? Those voices? Have you thought about
know.
That?
I don't I would like to say that it was a wonderful spiritual, you know, experience. I don't know if everybody gets that choice.
Well, I should say, I've interviewed Karen Smith, who was a survivor of the Bali bombings, right, in the Sari Club. And she, the first thing she recalls after the explosion going off was saying, all right, I'm going, because a voice was shouting in her head to get up, get up, get up, get up, get out of here. Mm. And she was shouting, all right, I'm doing it.
Mm. I've just had a chill go down my body. I so identify with that. And it's made me absolutely believe that there is so much more to the dimension and fullness of our lives than we'll ever understand, and how fortunate that I had that experience for me, and that I was offered a choice. And indeed, in making the choice to live, I signed a new contract with life.
Weird things happen to time. After something like this, after I had a recent injury, I was always focused on getting through the next 30 seconds, then the next minute, and it stopped me from panicking. I didn't panic. Mm. This is a common thing, apparently, too. Mm. Did you have that?
Absolutely. Time has been such an interesting subject for me to really think about throughout all of this, from the minutes that changed my life by being on that carriage in the first place. Even if I was a second earlier, I may have stood in a different position, and that could have cost me my life.
Or you could have been completely uninjured.
I could have been completely uninjured. And that is just, I mean, I don't want to think about it as a maddening, you know, sort of topic where you think, oh, if only, you know, I did this earlier. But it's, I think it's so interesting, and especially when then I look at what happened throughout my rescue, the intricate timing of just the right person at the right place in the right moment that did something to me that saved my life.
I suppose what I'm talking about is how after this, the worst thing in the world can happen, and yet somehow people can find themselves calm, rational and pragmatic.
Yeah.
And in break, doing the classic thing with, if you have a massive problem,
yeah,
and man, did you have a massive problem.
Yeah. Break it down.
Break it down. And, yeah, and you break it down into yeah, solvable,
yeah,
moments.
I think also the great worry I had, the only time I really panicked, is I didn't know if anyone knew we were down there. And now, of course, looking at the footage of that day, it was mayhem. I didn't know, of course, other bombs had gone off. It was mayhem above ground. Absolutely, people knew we were down there. But at the time, that was my panic, thinking, I've gotten through this moment. I don't know how long I've actually been here. I now know that we were waiting there for an hour before rescue could even get to us.
You were saying, Jill, you were there and you became quiet in the carriage after you'd been helped up onto the seat. You used the scuff to apply a tourniquet to your legs. Do you have any idea how long you waited there? As you were losing more and more blood.
Well, we believe now it was about an hour. So in military terms, there's this lovely descriptor of the golden hour, and if you're injured for over an hour before you get treatment, then you're fairly much written off. And so I'm incredibly lucky. And they believe that the tourniqueting with the scarf probably bought me about 10 minutes.
That male voice in your head telling you to live, did that keep going through? Once you'd made the resolution,
no.
It went quiet then, did it?
No, it all went quiet. So it was almost the moment I chose to live and signed this new invisible contract where I couldn't read the small print. and then everything kicked in, and just an absolute instinct of this is what you need to do to survive.
Do you remember seeing the rescuer? Who was the first rescuer that came to you?
I remember seeing the torch, and it is just that amazing moment of somebody knows we're here and they've come and I can surrender. And that's absolutely how I felt, that I just gave myself to them. And the person who first entered that carriage, her name is Tracy, and she's a paramedic, and she's one of my closest friends. She's like a sister to me now. So we're same age, same crazy girls, and yeah, it's beautiful. She's a real, you know, amazing addition to my life.
A policeman came and put a sticker on you that said priority one.
Yeah. I didn't know what a priority one was. It's better than a tour or a three, though, isn't it?
Under the circumstances, yeah. Yes. Yes.
And that's the last thing I remember hearing of that I was a priority one, and I knew I'm getting out of here. And there was five people that carried me out. I must just say, I'm very close to everybody that was involved in my rescue. We are like a little family. It's strange having so many brothers that are policemen, because I can do very little wrong, or I get away with a lot more. Don't know which I can say on radio. But my hand was held the whole time, and that it again kept me alive and connected.
There were no stretchers. How did they bring you out?
Tracy ingeniously, it was a summer day in London, so that ultimately meant that it was raining and people had overcoats on. And so there were coats strewn all over the ground of the carriage. And Tracy collected up all of these coats and shirts and made a makeshift structure that was a stretcher. And that's what they put me in.
Of course, the reason why there were no stretchers is because bombs had been going off elsewhere right across London.
But also you couldn't get anything down into the carriage because it was so twisted and didn't resemble a carriage at all.
Were they talking to you, your rescuers?
All the time.
What were they saying?
Stay with us. There was quite a lot of panic. I had two cardiac arrests on the platform, and they'd put me down and thought I'd gone. And then one policeman, Aaron, he's called, would hold my hand and squeeze my hand. And he said that great feeling that he could feel a squeeze come back, was like, she's back, let's go. And then on the platform, I've got these wonderful wounds just under my lungs of two biros that were stuck into my to inflate the lungs. So there was lots going on as I travelled down that tunnel, eventually to get into an ambulance. And there's a beautiful story of the ambulance travelling to the hospital because I arrested again on the way to the hospital. So for all intents and purposes, I was dead on arrival. And Brian, the paramedic in the ambulance, said, "Jill, you were dead. There was nothing on the monitor. There was, you know, no output." But he said, "But you were talking to me." And he said, "They put tubes down my throat." And he said, "I was looking at him, and you know," and he kept yelling to the driver, "She's dead, but talking, you know." And he said, "Now that he knows me," he said, "Ah, that makes sense. Why, why would being dead shut you up for a moment?" So, yeah, so that's a. And he said that haunted him because he said in all of his years in service, he'd never had anyone that was had no vital signs, but was actively talking.
You were brought into St. Thomas's Hospital.
Mm. Beloved St. Thomas's Hospital.
Yeah, you weren't conscious then, though, were you?
No.
So how could they identify you?
I was labelled, and I mean, it's very chilling, as one unknown estimated female. So they
estimated.
They kind of thought I was a female, but they put it down as estimated. And again, you know, life-saving amputation work where they just sewed up what was made the best of a bad job of what had already been severed. I'd lost at that time, I think, 80 to 85% of my blood. And I wasn't expected to live. And there's a wonderful resuscitation story. And I met the head of resus that morning. His name was Andy. And he was always a bit sort of sheepy around me. And I thought that's odd because everybody else had been so, you know, jubilant and euphoric that I'd survived. And there was.
So this is months or years later. After.
Yes, I'm a regular visitor back at the hospital to make sure there's cuddles all the time.
Okay. Yeah. So this is sometime later after you've recovered.
Yeah.
And this resuscitation expert was sheepish around you.
And I asked why and. As the story goes, he said that I'd been gone for just over 28 minutes, and he said that he wanted to call time of death, but that they had to do that as a collective in that room, and that not everybody else agreed with him. They wanted to continue. They wanted to make sure that my life was saved. So they all agreed that they would keep resuscitating for another 3 minutes and 30 seconds, and at which time they would then call time of death. Well, after 3 minutes, the monitor started beeping. So I'm here by 30 seconds. And I'm very, I always say that with a great big smile on my face, just in the nick of time.
You were gone for 28 minutes? How can anyone be dead that long? Your brain damage and...
Still the same bad sense of humour I had before. I mean, it's amazing.
What was the full nature of your injuries, apart from the legs?
So burns, eardrums, collapsed lungs, various debris. I had a set of car keys in the back of my head. So because everything becomes then a flying weapon, you know, even coins, everything becomes airborne.
Shrapnel.
And, yeah.
How were you eventually identified? Tell me about the detective who figured out your name.
Wonderful. So his name is James, and James was left with the terrible job of the medical team said to James, "We think probably at best you've got about a half an hour before this person goes. So you better find out who it is and get next of kin here." And James, you know, there he is as a, you know, Scotland Yard detective, said he just looked at this body and thought, where do I start? And he said a prayer over my body And he said at the end of that prayer, which was, he was just saying, please God, help me, that my eyes flickered. And he said, my God, what just happened there? You know, but that led him to think of, if the eyes can flicker, perhaps there could be a blinking that could happen. So he went through the alphabet and asked me to blink at each letter to spell my name, and out came Jill Hicks.
Gee, just as well you haven't got a gigantic name, said. Isn't it?
Or I'd rather have blinked Angelina Jolie just to see what happens. Get me, Brad.
Of course, you wouldn't remember that, would you?
No, don't remember a thing. Don't remember a thing.
When you awoke, how did it feel to know you'd survived?
Euphoric. I think that has really protected me and wrapped me in that euphoria and an immediate understanding of how incredibly precious it is to have a life. And I knew I was Jill. So even with all the life support and I couldn't communicate as best as Jill could, I knew I was still Jill. And that was everything. I knew I didn't have legs. I knew I was confined to this strange bed with lots of tubes coming out of me. But I knew I'd made it. I was still me. And that was everything. And that sense, and also being wrapped and experienced so much unconditional love. And I'd never say this lightly, in that Tracy entering the carriage, she didn't have to do that. She made a choice that day to come and save as many people as she could, putting her own life at risk. All of those officers running down that tunnel made a choice to come and save as many people as they could, putting their own lives at risk. They didn't know if there'd be a secondary device. They didn't know if the tunnel would collapse. And they placed the life of human beings above their own. That meant everything. I also felt... And coming back to Mum, when Mum died, I thought I'd lost unconditional love forever. And I had it back.
From strangers.
From strangers. And that is why I don't feel any hatred, because it's too precious. What I've been given back is too precious to allow the cancerous nature of hatred and bitterness to decay my life. I would say I'm angry. And I think that's okay. But equally, it's the anger that gets me up in the morning to say, what am I going to do about it?
Jill Hicks was unlucky to be late for work, lucky because she got a scarf, unlucky to get on that train on the Piccadilly line, lucky because there was some space between you and the bomber, unlucky to have lost her legs, lucky that people found her in time, just in time, lucky that she was survived and people didn't give up, and lucky that she survived. Do you think of yourself as lucky or unlucky, or don't you think in those terms?
I guess I don't often think in those terms. But if I was to think of my story, I would say I'm incredibly fortunate and incredibly blessed. I've through extreme loss, I've gained and understood so much. Would I prefer to turn the clock back and be oblivious? Absolutely. But that's not possible.
We're all fortunate to be here, aren't we?
Every life counts.
We now know a fair bit about the bomber on your train. He was a troubled 19-year-old who'd fallen under the influence of a bad mind. Mm. I think it's fair to say that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Many people wouldn't see him as troubled and want to say he was wicked. What do you think?
I'd like to believe, and this is again, you know, he's dead. And so we can only ever presume what he thought. And I'm very cautious of making presumptions, because on that morning, he presumed a hell of a lot of things about me. He presumed I was his enemy, and he never asked me. I never had a choice. So I don't want to presume too much about him, but the space that I like to think about with him, and indeed what he symbolises, is that there is a passion to the crime, and that these are people that are wanting to make a difference, albeit in a very misguided way. So it's how do we highlight that the killing of innocent lives, an eye for an eye, doesn't make a situation better.
Is there a point where someone perpetrates a crime that's really so monstrous, it gets beyond the point of rage and hate? It's just too big to feel anything other than sad about?
I'm sure there is. I feel a great pity for him, and pity is perhaps the only emotion I can offer him as he's not here.
So this, after a while, and as you were learning to walk again on new legs, got you thinking about the cycle of violence.
Mm.
What did you... Tell me about how that process, that thought unfolded.
Well, I thought about, how this happens, how anyone could feel justified in that type of attack. Indeed, how common this attack is throughout the world, and a source of terrorism is a very effective source of getting people to sit up and listen and take notice. And I thought about, how do I end this? Because I'm just one person. So what I can do is I can actually stop an idea of a cycle of this continuing, of wanting retribution. So how can I reverse that cycle and in fact go out and do the complete opposite?
Because to want retribution is to kind of exact another toll in you, isn't it?
Absolutely. And then it keeps going.
Yeah.
And then it keeps going. And then where does it end? Where does it end? You know, do I say to all the 19-year-old lads in Leeds, can you all please lay down while I amputate your legs? What? There's no satisfaction in that for anybody. So what do we do? You know, there has to be a line that's drawn that says it stops here.
So then how did that lead to setting up your organisation, Mad for Peace, which is a great name for a charity?
I think because those who know me very well know that there's a little crazy spark. There's also the my previous life has always been in the arts and design. So I instinctively again thought, how do I combine the two? How do we create some sort of interesting projects around peace? Indeed, how do we challenge peace?
What do you mean by challenge peace?
Well, peace is one of those eye-rolling subjects. And I found this only too well when I go to a party and someone says, oh, what do you do? And I'll say, oh, I work in peace. They go, oh, that's nice. And then they off they go. And you think, and I might come back with a mineral water. I go, well, where's my gin and tonic? You work in peace. That means you wouldn't have a gin and tonic, would you? So it's challenging. And I think I like to be a person to say, actually, peace is tough. Peace is a tougher option than what Jermaine Lindsay did that morning. For him to stand there and say, okay, I this is my cause and I want to do something about that, that takes a lot more, in fact, of life dedication than detonating a bomb.
Peace is sometimes something you have to fight through, though, isn't it? I mean, that's the awful thing about it. The most obvious case of that, of course, is the Second World War, where there was nothing short of horrible violence that was
Absolutely.
Going to bring peace.
Yeah.
Sometimes that is required, isn't it?
Yes and no. I think, again, it's how we talk about peace. If we talk about peace as a lack of war, then absolutely. I've now started to look at it, because therefore we need to then start to explore the subject of, is peace ever possible? So for me to answer that, then I talk about peace as being something that we have in within us, and that we can have peace within us, and it starts with us. Instead of talking about peace, I then, given whatever environment, I'll then talk about living in confidence. And is that really a state of peace, where we can live in confidence with each other, where I have an ability to agree to disagree without having my life at threat? And so that air of confidence is what ultimately I'm aiming to achieve. And that's through saying, within all of us, we have the ability to say, it ends with me.
What was the moment when this idea started, that you would do something if you lived?
It was in the carriage. So that moment...
In this smoky,
absolutely,
dark carriage?
Absolutely.
With you bleeding to death?
Yep, absolutely. That I didn't know what it would look like. I didn't know what exactly I'd be doing, but I knew I'd be doing something that was about serving my life.
Was that something that voice commanded you to do? I'm serious. Is it that male?
It was the small print contract that I didn't get to see. I didn't know that I wouldn't be earning very much money ever again. But
so no, right there and then,
I knew that if I survived, that my life had to be spent giving back and making it count and making a difference. So making a difference was absolutely born in those first moments.
I'm with Jill Hicks today in conversation. Jill is the founder and director of Mad for Peace. It's a peace-based charity. So you see yourself as an actionist, not an activist. What's the difference there?
An actionist is a doer. And I would like to talk about thinking about peace as a verb, something that we do, we consciously do, and we put into action. So rather than being an activist or a campaigner or a protester, it's saying, okay, let's not talk about it, let's do it, let's put peace into action.
What, personal choice. It's a series of personal choices.
Absolutely. And we're all good enough to make those choices.
Mad for Peace is instigating things called mad nests all over the place. What are mad nests and what's the inspiration for mad nests?
Well, the inspiration, strangely or not so strangely enough, comes from the terrorist cell network. And it's a very, very, very effective network of distributing destructive ideas through internet, through cells, through meeting places. And I thought, and through very little money and funding. And I thought, well, how do we mirror that? So rather than setting up something called a cell ourselves, we thought, what's a positive idea? And a nest is where something's born and then people can grow and spring from the nest and then go and create their own nest. So then we thought about, from a business point of view, how do we make that sustainable? How do we make peace sustainable and get people being actionists and get people doing throughout the world and connecting to each other? Because often, peace can feel very isolating, especially if you're in a country where there is such unrest and conflict. To be a person who wants peace can be very lonely. So how do we build a world around that person to make them feel that they're actually not alone and they're part of a bigger concern? We've been looking at business franchise models. So how do we franchise peace and how do people then be sustaining financially through their own franchise?
So how do the nests work then?
Anyone can set up a nest who wants to create something in their community. So we've got education nests, so they can be school kids in their school. They can be community nests. They can be individuals who want to get others involved in their particular projects. And why it works is it's specific to those locations. So it meets the needs of whatever's needed in those communities.
Give me an example of some functioning mad nests you've got up and running and who they're communicating with.
So we've got lovely stories actually coming from Australia and Pakistan. So the work we've been doing over the years with schools here in Adelaide have now come to fruition where the people that were in a nest are called mad ones. So mad ones get to talk to each other. And we've got these wonderful situations where these girls in Adelaide are talking to people, to other mad ones in Pakistan, and getting this first person view of the world, quite often with things that don't get reported. And it's amazing. Equally, we've got nests in Milwaukee. And again, these Adelaide girls, young girls, 17, 18-year-olds, talking to mad ones in Milwaukee.
And what do they talk about? What kind of conversations do they have?
Talking about how to influence others of choosing peace, talking about life. So quite often, so we've got very dynamic nests around the world. So the people in Milwaukee are former white supremacists. So they've then come from a life of hatred to understand that that's not the way forward, and they've rehabilitated to become functioning, giving human beings. And their knowledge is very interesting. It's very interesting, especially when we've seen what we saw in Norway of the massacre there, of people to be able to try and get an understanding of that thinking.
You've received lots of awards for your work. In fact, the Queen's given you an MBE, I think it is.
Yeah.
MBE?
Yeah.
What's that like? Stand in the queue on the uncomfortable prosthetic leg, waiting for Her Maj to walk by and go, yeah.
Amazing. Just amazing. It obviously, in the grand scheme of things, you know, these things don't really matter. But to be
kind of interesting, though.
But to be acknowledged for anything is because it's again, I use the word lonely, but it's lonely work. It's about plodding and influencing. It can't always be about me. It has to be about me influencing someone to go and do it themselves, and then those people influence others to go and do it themselves. So for things to come back to me to say, Jill, you're doing a great job, that means a lot.
Is it difficult to remain positive?
Yeah, it's coming out from the starting blocks, it was full of, triumphs of, look, I can stand and look, I can walk. And I think 7 years on, it's the realisation that it's permanent.
Jill, it's been absolutely amazing speaking with you. I've so enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thanks, Richard.
I spoke to Jill Hicks early last year in her hometown of Adelaide. And since we last spoke, I'm really pleased to tell you that Jill and her partner have become proud parents of a much longed-for, beautiful baby girl.